Senate Education Committee will come to order.
It seems like we have kind of a repeat.
Before we begin the agenda, I would like to let you know that I haven't been ignoring your homework. I appreciate the numbers that have come in, and Greg Marcus, our committee administrator, has forwarded them to the department for a request for information. And it may have been a tad overwhelming to them, but I think we're going to follow up with a recommendation that they at least select some of them that would be a good model for demonstrating what the new system of data can in fact do and provide for us, and as well as give us some feedback on what's available in terms of the others that have been sent your way. And if others of you didn't have a chance to follow up on that, I don't give demerits for late homework assignment to turn in. So you're more than welcome to pass that on. We'll see what we can learn from and evaluate from what our current data system is. But today we're privileged to have with us folks from the Bush Foundation and the group that has kind of coalesced around the issue of creating world-class schools for world-class jobs for Minnesota's future. And so we have a few folks that are part of this coalition who will be making a presentation today. And I believe Charlie Weaver is under the weather and isn't here, and Jim Bartholomew is going to stand in for him. And why don't we begin with you? Thank you for coming, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And Charlie, the ardent Viking fan that he is not feeling quite so well today. let me start with some contextual stuff.
I'm still wearing the black and gold.
And hopefully the slides will catch up. As you've all heard, two-thirds of all jobs in the next 8 years are going to require some form of post-secondary education. No longer is a high school diploma sufficient. And for Minnesota to compete on a global basis, that's not only something that we need to pay attention to as a state for our economy, but for the individual students that are going through our system. I think that's the thing we need to keep in mind, that as we talk about economic development and education, that really is kids, the next generation. And one of the slides talks about the U.S.'s ability to compete globally in a knowledge-based economy. And one of the things to keep in mind, just to put this in context a little bit, is China has more English-speaking people than the United States. More English-speaking people than the U.S., and they also have the world's largest higher ed system. So I kind of think about that for a little bit, and they're growing, and doing everything they can to improve.
Yes, Mr. Bartholomew, they also have a higher population than we do. Proportionate to their population, do they have more English-speaking people than we do?
Just as a, Madam Chair, just as a straight-up number, they have more than we do. And that's still their untapped pool as well. Fortunately, Minnesota is coming from a position of strength nationally, internationally. We've done very well. Most of you have probably heard that Minnesota's fourth and eighth grade students were at or near the top in reading achievement in the 2010 NAEP exam. We have some of the highest ACT scores in the nation. We have great high school graduation rates. And then thanks to the legislature in 2007, we participated in the TIMSS assessment, an international assessment that looked at math and science. In between 1995 and 2007, Minnesota's fourth graders we're just on the cusp of being amongst the best in the world in math. And our growth rate from 95 to 2007 was three times that of the U.S. as an average. So we have some very good, solid strengths in Minnesota. Let's see. That said, there are also some reasons for concern. 2 weeks ago, the report was released talking about remediation rates for Minnesota public post-secondary students who are graduates of high schools. As a resident of Edina with a daughter who's just graduated from there, I was a little surprised to find that 23% of Edina's high school seniors moving on to a public post-secondary in Minnesota needed a remedial course. The state average is 40%. You've heard about the achievement gap, and one of the other things on this, the third bullet down, 3% of Minnesota's African-American and American Indian ninth graders will receive a bachelor's degree by the time they're 25. 3%. As the partnership has looked at education reform over the years, we've really just looked at it through four basic principles. Set rigorous, world-class standards, expectations for students. Measure their progress against those standards and report that out. The third is give educators the flexibility they believe they need to deliver those standards and help kids achieve those. And then the fourth is give families the ability to choose the educational program that best meets their needs. About 3-4 years ago, our members, as well as the members of Itasca and the Chamber and Bush, thinking about those first few slides, that Minnesota does really well in a number of areas, but there are also some areas that are causing great concern. Our members started to wonder, how well are we doing? What's fact? What's fiction? So we asked McKinsey and Company, who's done a number of global studies of successful educational systems, to look at Minnesota's education system in particular and compare it to the best performing systems internationally. And then that second bullet, what are they doing that we aren't or that we could do better to better align our system so our kids will have an internationally competitive education? And McKinsey went off. It was about a year-long study. They had a panel of Minnesota-based experts, and they came back and found that we do obviously have many strengths. Our standards are amongst the best in the world. Our aligned assignments or assessments also are equally strong. They actually found that Minnesota's school funding is relatively stable and predictable. So we have some good foundation to work from. They also found, however, that there were some areas for improvement, and these basically centered on the four bullets you see. Improve, reform, teacher preparation, recruit top talent to high needs area in teaching fields, school leadership development, as you all heard last week with the principals that came from Farnsworth and Concordia and Sibley East, the difference that a quality school can make in an institution into a school. And then as they tried to mention, and you heard from Ms. Gadara and the department, use data to drive instruction, to improve performance. So basically, we're doing well. We have good standards and expectations in assessment. Our funding system, we'll always argue about that, but essentially it's stable, predictable. But if we want to better align our system to the best in the world, not too surprisingly, we need to look at maintaining and building teacher quality, building school leadership capacity, and continually using data to drive performance.
Mr. Bartholomew, the second point when you said attracting top talent to high-need areas, are you talking geographic or subject matter?
Madam Chair, that could be both, whether it's to some of the geographically isolated schools or to the STEM areas. And your actions over the last, this session, one reflection of this bullet was alternative teacher licensure, again, to attract and expand the pool of available high-quality people into the teaching profession. as you have a deeper pool, hopefully those shortage areas can be satisfied.
Madam Chair?
Senator Wheeler.
Thank you for that question. I just have a follow-up. Mr. Bartholomew, attracting top talent, and that's great. You represent the top corporations. Generally, you get the top talent because the money's better.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Senator Wheeler. I don't know if you're asking if we get the top talent for people who would otherwise be teachers or that we get the top talent globally for employees of our firms. One way to respond, though, is that one of the former chairs of our education committee, they are based in Eden Prairie. They almost exactly a third of their business was in Europe, a third was in the U.S., and a third was in Asia. And he was very instrumental in getting this whole project started because he could see what was going on in Europe and especially in Asia with the conversation about China and India. And their commitment is to stay here, based in Eden Prairie. But that's one of those where if you're not moving ahead, you're falling behind kind of categories. That's what spurred this whole study, was are we doing as well as, because they want to stay here. They need to attract the top talent to stay here. And if we don't have the top talent, they'll regrettably go where they need to go. And in order to maintain their base here, the whole point of this is to make sure Minnesota students are as well educated as possible so we can all thrive.
Well, Mr. Bartholomew, I think I don't want to put words in Senator Wheeler's mouth, but I think he's wondering if the top talent isn't pursuing education because of the salaries are lower than what they could get in these related fields in industry. Have you done any, as part of the project, done anything about looking into that area?
Teacher salaries, mm-hmm. Madam Chair? Madam Chair, there was some work that looked at teacher salaries. If I can grab the book, we do have a chart. And to summarize it, I think a number of the other countries basically front load the salaries. They increase beginning teacher salaries, but then it kind of where ours starts low and steadily rises, they basically start high and that increase is less pronounced. So that was one of their strategies for getting people into the field.
Thank you.
If that's helpful. So again, based on McKinsey's work, and again, that's, I should have pointed out, is this booklet. Us, the partnership, the Itasca Project, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Bush Foundation have been working together under the Minnesota's Future Initiative, both legislatively and non-legislatively, to pursue progress in each of these four areas. Again, reforming teacher preparation, attracting top talent, building school leadership, and using better data. Just quickly, the principal leadership, we've been working. There are two statewide programs that work on this. One out of the university focuses on traditional principals. The other out of McAllister works primarily with charter and alternative schools. Together with the chamber, we've provided mentors for participants, speakers, facilities. The data, we've supported the department's development of their longitudinal data system, which you heard about last week. Again, we have a member sitting on the governance committee trying to help the department and others work through some of the issues of setting up that system. And then just generally trying to get some support for education reform, race to the top. If you'll recall, last session, we were part of an effort that had over 100 community leaders sign a letter in support of Minnesota's Race to the Top application and the supporting legislation. And on the teacher front, this is where I'll let Mr. Hutchinson speak because they've really taken the lion's share, been out front on this, and we're more of a supportive role to the Bush Foundation's efforts. But we've also been supportive of Teach for America, trying to bring that to Minnesota. And at that point, unless there are questions, again, it's just McKinsey had a chance to look at our system specifically and compared it to some of the top performing systems in the world. And you can see the countries we looked at. And I think the message is a good one. Minnesota, in many ways, has a strong base to work from. And we're at a place where we can use that strength to build and change while we're strong and improve and be globally competitive. And again, it's just, and again, for education, it's, you know, quality teachers, school leadership development, and better use of data. And thank you and the committee for efforts in the past and going forward. Really been helpful in all of those areas. And unless there are questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hutchinson, who's got some exciting stuff.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question. Would our education system in Minnesota be better with national standards?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bartholomew.
Senator Stump, conceptually, we've supported the Common Core effort in English and in math. Our support has been conditioned, if you will, as long as those standards are at least as good as what we already have. We should not participate if it means we're going to sacrifice quality. But if the quality is there, then that's an open issue. And there are a lot of points to be made, yeah. And that's what, you know, to the degree we're in with the English language arts, it makes a lot of sense. That's
Senator Stump?
Well, Madam Chair, it's hard to know whether the standards, where they had come down. When you kind of get into that national standards issue, I suppose you could pass I don't even know if they give you a chance to say, well, I'll opt in only if our standards are above your standards.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Senator Stump, I think the one benefit we had with the English language arts standards was the Common Core were being developed on the same cycle as our English language, so we were able to develop those somewhat simultaneously. So we knew what was going on there fairly well. From our perspective, we heard the testimony, and particularly I can recall the House testimony from the two chairs of the Math Standards Committee, Ms. Delaney and Dr. Gray, last year, expressing concerns about the math standards. Also understand that the Minnesota Teachers of Math Association was going to look, do a comparison between the Common Core. We're not equipped to, as you suggest, we're not equipped to do that. But if the math teachers are going to look at it and give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, I
think. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bartholomew, one of the things that I think we may call on the business community going forward is some partnership with regard to financial support. And I know that in the past, foundations have provided financial support for certain initiatives like the some of the High Tech Association and other related foundations have given money for technology-related things. But as we look at our budget shortfall and the high goals and standards that you've set forward, I would ask you to consider where the business community couldn't strategically invest. You know, sometimes to make reform and to make changes, you need to invest some things. And the Commission on Service Innovation, of which you had a member on that, talked about the importance, and I'm seeing Peter Hutchinson back there because it was really his idea, about creating venture capital to invest on reforms that will pay off down the road, perhaps even like in a revolving fund. And so I just bring that up because I think we are short of money, and I think we do want to make some pretty significant changes, and so we may need to have a stronger public-private partnership in the future. And I know, for example, with MELF, they raised quite a bit of money from the foundation community and put that money to good use.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, one of the non-legislative things we're doing in connection with this.
Could you just move the mic a little bit? You're not picking up on their system.
One of the things non-legislatively we're doing in connection with this is to try to work with the foundation community to see if we can't come up with an inventory of who's doing what and where and how effectively. My memory, we'll obviously be open to supporting however we can, but I am amazed at how many things the employer and foundation community do in Minnesota right now. Mm-hmm. My memory is there's over $225 million a year in foundation and corporate giving to education, as well as the non-financial things that employers do. So I think the key is to find it. There's a lot going on, and I think it'll be incumbent on us to help give you a better picture of what that is and for us to coordinate.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair?
Senator Reagan.
May I ask another question, Mr. Bartholomew?
Certainly.
In the ITESCA report, I believe page 12, you have a graph, and it suggests that we're top-heavy in administration. More money needs to go to the classroom. And would you like to elaborate further on that and any suggestions as to how we accomplish that goal?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bartholomew.
Senator Rieger, that's an excellent point, because you look at the chart on page 11 that shows the overall funding, and then, yeah, when you go to page 12, it gives you a glimpse of how that money is being spent. I was looking this weekend at some other statistics that the Census Bureau put out, and for what it's worth, I guess, when they compared us as a state nationally, we're 47th lowest in school administration, but fourth highest in district administration. I don't know exactly what that means, but it's always a question of where and how you're spending your money, as much as how much. And this gives us a glimpse of maybe where we could start to look.
Okay. Mr. Brown, would you repeat those numbers? You said we're 47th
lowest in school administration.
So that's the building level.
Yeah, and then general district level administration, I believe, was fourth, maybe fifth.
Fourth. That
fourth.
Would point to your larger school districts, probably. Thank you very
Madam
much.
Madam Chair, I have a question, please.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Bartholomew, I am going to ask this question to all of you today because I'm curious about, you know, I've read so many reports that come from partnerships, coalitions that are working, public sector, private sector coalitions, that have these very good statements, very broad statements that no one could disagree with, like transform traditional teacher preparation, followed by a sentence that I said, absolutely, I agree with that. And so on. I'm not going to read all of them. Mm-hmm. Yet, we have never worked on putting together a plan for the state of Minnesota that actually talks about this is where we are, this is where we want to be, and in order to get there, we have to take these four or five steps. Some of us are going to disagree with that. Some people are going to agree. But in order to get from point A to point B, you must follow a map. Minnesota has never developed a plan. We just put these statements that clearly I will never disagree with. I may have some opinions about, you know, how we can get there, but I think the problem has been how do we get there, not that we don't want to get there. And you've been around long enough, and I wonder why is that you think that we have never come together to put a plan?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, on the one hand, that's a wonderful segue to Mr. Hutchinson. The Bush Foundation has a plan. We think a very solid plan that's going to make a huge difference for Minnesota, especially, as he'll describe, over the next 10 years when half our teaching force retires. We have a tremendous opportunity to do something better. And the Bush Foundation is working hard on that, and we're very supportive of what they're doing. We have also, I'll follow up with you, we do have some very specific plans for how we plan to go forward in building school leadership capacity for making better use of data. Some of the points that are in the insert are steps that, as a legislature, we would encourage you to look at doing. Many of these include developing the people we have in our schools now to help good get great and keep the great great. We have a non-legislative agenda as well, and I'd be happy to visit with you, but I think perhaps Mr. Hutchinson would be the perfect example of what we have for a plan to address one of the main issues we have.
Well, that's a good introduction. We'll call Peter Hutchinson to the table, and Susan Hegard is with him, so welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hutchinson. I'm the president of the Bush Foundation, and with me is Susan Hegard, who's our vice president for educational achievement. For those of you who are less familiar with the Bush Foundation, Archibald Bush was a farm kid from Granite Falls, Minnesota. Always thought he was going to be a farmer until he realized he had asthma. So he had to figure out what he wanted to do with his life, and he moved to Duluth because the climate is better, and enrolled in the enrolled in the Duluth Business College in an accounting program with the expectation that he would become an accountant, do indoor work, and the asthma wouldn't be such a big problem. He got halfway through the course, and he got a call from a fellow who had graduated from that course the year before and had been hired as the assistant accountant for a little company in Duluth and had now been promoted to be the full-fledged accountant. And he wanted to hire Archibald Bush as the new assistant accountant. And that guy's name was McKnight. And McKnight and Bush together ran the 3M Corporation for 46 years. In 1953, each of them created a foundation. The McKnight Foundation is in Minneapolis, and the Bush Foundation's here in St. Paul. So it's all about little tiny companies that do great things and leave these wonderful legacies. We are blessed in Minnesota to have many organizations like this, and Susan and I are blessed to be part of this particular one. So I want to start with a story. We're going to show you some charts and graphs, but charts and graphs are never as important as the people behind them. In 2006, in a moment of total craziness on my part, I ran for governor of this state, and one day I found myself in a bar in Deer River, Minnesota, because unlike successful politicians like you, I thought there were votes in this bar. What did I know? And I'm working my way down the bar, saying hi to everybody, and I get down to the end, and there's this young woman sitting at the bar talking to her buddy, and she twirls around as I come up, and she looks me in the eye, and she says, "You lied to me." And I said, "Gosh, I haven't even had a chance to lie to you. What could I possibly have done?" And she said, "I don't mean you personally. I mean you adults. You lied to me." And I said, what happened? She said, "Look, I did everything you all told me to do. I went to school every day. I had nearly perfect attendance. I did my homework every night, just like you told me I had to do. I took the hard courses, like you told me I was supposed to do. I basically got straight A's in high school. And I graduated with a Minnesota high school diploma, like you told me I needed. Then I enrolled in college, just like you told me I was supposed to do. And I got there, and I took the placement exams, and guess what? I had to take math and reading over again. I got straight A's in high school, and I had to take math and reading over again when I got to college. You lied to me." I've never been able to forget this young woman. That story is not very unique, actually. Among the people sitting in this room, the district that does the best has 29% of their kids taking math and reading over again when they get to college. And among the people sitting in this room, the worst is about 74%. It's not working. It's not working for too many of our kids, and it's not working for too many of our kids across the state in every district. It's It's not working. We have, and you have, what feels to me like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Now, that's probably because I'm an old guy and there aren't going to be that many more opportunities in my life. But we have a unique opportunity in this state. In the next 10 years, half of all of our teachers are going to retire. And you as policymakers, and maybe we as a foundation, have an opportunity to affect who the next 25,000 teachers are going to be. And as I'll show you in a second, if we get the very best, the very most effective in our classrooms, we can change the trajectory of education in Minnesota. And we can close the education gaps that we all talk about. We can do that. And some of you are brand new in this job, and I don't think you're going to have many more opportunities like this starting out. This is absolutely unique. And what I want to try to, and I appreciate Senator Torres-Ray's question, what I want to try to persuade you is there actually is a way forward. It's powerful. It could be successful. And what the Bush Foundation has done is made a choice about 2 years ago to go down this path. It's the largest single commitment our organization has ever made to anything. We're investing $40 million over the next 10 years to transform teacher preparation in Minnesota, and we invite you to be our partner, because I think we could do something pretty special. So there are three big challenges when we were looking at the education challenges in Minnesota. By the way, we also operate in North Dakota and South Dakota, so some of what I'll show you is a three-state stuff, but mostly it's Minnesota. One is attainment. Attainment is not high enough, and it's not getting better. Secondly, we are at risk right now in Minnesota of having our education system actually be a drag on our economy, which would be the first time in my life in Minnesota that anyone has ever thought that way about our education system. It's always been the reverse, that the education system was the engine of our economy. Woe be us if we let it be a drag on our economy. And the disparities among people in this state and among populations are too huge for us to sustain. This first graph is about what we get for the money. Are we getting as much as we could? And here's the important takeaway. In the last 35 years, we have nearly doubled in real dollars the number of dollars we spend per pupil in Minnesota. We've nearly doubled in real dollars. There's no inflation up here. Our financial commitment to each and every child in our K-12 system. And if you look at those reading score lines, we've basically got nothing in return. Now, this assessment, by the way, is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So this isn't Minnesota standards, a Minnesota test. This is the national assessment, the only national assessment we have. It's not that Minnesotans haven't tried. It's not that you haven't tried. We've invested. But we're not getting the upward slope that we would expect from that kind of investment, especially in terms of reading. And math is a little bit better, but frankly, none of it is good enough. Our levels of attainment are just not adequate to what we're after. Secondly, as Mr. Bartholomew said a second ago, about 69% of the jobs going forward are going to require some level of education after high school. 69%. Keep that number in mind. 69%. How are we doing today? About 27% of our ninth graders end up with a degree after high school, a two-year degree or a four-year degree, about 27%. What do we need? 69. What are we getting? 27. This is how our education system risks our economy. We need to dramatically alter the effectiveness of our education system if we're going to deliver that 69% that we need to achieve. And you can see how it works. Only half of our kids show up for school ready in kindergarten. Between 30 and 40% of our kids end up being proficient in math or reading at the appropriate grade levels. 75% of our kids graduate from high school. 58% of our kids enroll in college, but only 27% end up with a degree after high school. Now, we've got to be clear. That's like the best in the country. The problem with that is it's like being the tallest pygmy. we can't get where we want to get at that level of achievement. We just can't do it. As good as it is compared to everybody else in this country, it's not good enough. And if you're a kid of color or a poor kid, you're just much better off, much worse off, much worse off. And if you're a black boy in Minnesota, your odds of getting a degree after high school are more like 2 or 3%. So the fastest growing parts of our educational population are actually the ones with which we're doing the worst job. And our gap, you may hear this a million times, and you need to be outraged by this. Our gap in educational achievement based on race, ethnicity, and income is the largest in the country. This is not something we want to put in the brochures when we talk about what it's like to be a Minnesotan. We can't live with this level of achievement. So what do you do? Now, what feels like a million years ago, I was a school superintendent in Minneapolis for 4 years. And we tried a lot of stuff, most of which is on this slide. There's a lot of strategies for improving educational outcomes. And we've tried many of them. We've tried virtually all of them. And some of them work some of the time. We've hardly ever been able to get to scale on any one of them. As we looked at it as a foundation, we looked at all these possibilities, and we've chosen to focus on the preparation of teachers, on the effectiveness of the teacher in the classroom. And I'd be the last one to tell you this is the only strategy that's out there, and there's a million people who come and tell you about other good strategies. But today, for today's purposes, we want to focus just on this question of teacher effectiveness. And here's why. In one of those duh moments that happens occasionally in your life, it turns out that teachers actually do matter. Now, we've said this for years and years and years. But look at this piece of data. This happens to come from Tennessee. Start out with two groups of kids at the 50th percentile. So average. Give one group of those kids really effective teachers for 3 years in a row. They move from the 50th to the 90th percentile. Effective teachers really are fantastic. You would all want your kids in their classrooms. But look what happens to a comparable group of kids with 3 years of ineffective teaching. They end up at the 37th percentile, a 53% difference. Now, what this slide doesn't show you, but the same data set does, is those kids that get three ineffective teachers in a row, they never recover. There's no way back. You can only be in third grade once, and fourth grade once, and fifth grade once, and if you don't get it in those grades, there's no way back. Even more profound, this data happens to come from Dallas, it's the same basic analysis, is the impact of effective teaching on closing the achievement gap. Now here you got three groups of kids. The group on the right were high-performing fourth graders already. The group in the middle were middle-performing fourth graders, and the group on the left, they were low-performing fourth graders. Now, in each one of those groups, half got effective teaching for 3 years in a row, and half got ineffective teaching for 3 years in a row. And you can see for those fourth graders that are already high-performing, not such a big difference between effective and ineffective teaching. Even the middle group, not such a big difference between effective and ineffective teaching. But look at those low-performing fourth graders. The fourth graders that got effective teaching for 3 years in a row got themselves up to the 89th percentile. They virtually closed the achievement gap. That's why effective teaching matters so much. And that's why it's so important to focus on the whole next 25,000 teachers. Not a couple of them, not a few of them, not a pilot project, the whole 25,000. Because here's the deal. We're going to replace all 25,000. If you do nothing, they're still going to be replaced. If we do nothing, they're still going to be replaced. The question is not whether they're going to be replaced. The question is who's going to replace them? Who will be in those classrooms? Which group of teachers will our kids get? And if we could find a strategy to assure that the next 25,000 teachers were the most effective possible, you can see what the consequences might be for Minnesota. If I were in South Dakota, I'd be saying for South Dakota or North Dakota, but the point is it really does matter who these teachers are. So what the foundation has been doing is trying to understand what it would take to change the outcome for these next 25,000 teachers, to change the basic structure, the systems by which we prepare teachers in Minnesota. And Susan Hegard has been the champion of this work. And so what I'm going to ask her to do is describe the approach that we've been taking. And then we can talk a little bit about where we are in it, how it's going, and some of the other issues that you've already raised, so you can get a sense of what it might take. And then let's talk about what it might mean to be partners in making this happen. Susan.
Great. Thanks, Madam Chair and members. I'm Susan Hegard with the Bush Foundation. And thank you for the nice compliment about being the champion. But our champions really are in the partner institutions that we're working with. They're taking on some very tough issues inside their organizations and then working with their K-12 partners. And I also want to recognize Stephanie Andrews, who works with me on this at the foundation, too. So I wanted to just step back a little bit and give you some national perspective. If any of you were here for the Arne Duncan luncheon a few weeks ago, he shared some of his thoughts with the gang, the 600 folks who were at the chamber luncheon. But there's a lot of attention and focus on teachers and teaching right now. It's really an exciting time, and there's a window of opportunity. The Gates Foundation has invested millions of dollars over the years in various reforms. And right now they're focused on something called Measures of Effective Teaching, or MET. And they're working deeply, these deep dives they're doing in a number of districts around the country. They're looking at all sorts of different assessments, ways in which to evaluate teachers. And we're really happy because some of the folks that we're working with on our evaluation are also working on the Gates Project. So there's a lot of learning to be shared there. And when we learn more, we'd be happy to share that with you. The Woodrow Wilson Foundation has been pursuing improved teacher preparation in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and there's some very exciting work there as well. One of their advisors is on our advisory committee. The Carnegie Corporation was involved with the largest effort so far to improve teacher preparation, Teachers for a New Era, and they worked with, 10 or so institutions across the country trying to improve teacher preparation. And then finally, the federal government, through Race to the Top, through the Teacher Incentive Fund grants, and there's some other efforts, I3, they've also had a focus on improved teacher preparation. So there's a lot of movement and momentum on this and attention here in our country right now. So as Peter mentioned, Mr. Hutchinson mentioned, our goal is to deliver 25,000 effective new teachers by the end of the decade. And I hope this, Senator Torres-Ray, this gets to your concern about being specific about a plan, because we'll get quite specific here today. And that 25,000 teachers represents 50% of today's teachers who will leave in the next decade across our three-state area, North and South Dakota and Minnesota. So what's the definition we're using for effectiveness? We've decided that's achieving at least 1 year of student academic growth in 1 year of classroom time. We're using a value-added assessment to measure that growth, plus some other measures too, peer review and some other things. But that's the way in which we're defining effectiveness. So this slide is important because I think it's important to understand the pipeline issue that's involved with people coming into the hoping to come into the teaching profession. So if you look, this is Minnesota data, but the point here is that many people are coming in to become teachers, and many people are falling out within 5 years for various reasons. Some ought to go, but we're losing many people along the pipeline. We're also losing an opportunity to recruit some great people into the profession, and we'll talk about that too. So this slide shows you that in 2007, there were 4,201 teacher licensure candidates prepared here. Out of that group, about 2,700 were hired, and after 5 years, about 1,900 are expected to remain. So there are a couple questions here. One is, what's the value added for the individual, and then for the taxpayer, when we're talking about that investment in a person as they move through that system to become a teacher. The other important point here is that if you looked inside the numbers, many of these folks are being prepared for elementary education, and there needs to be a better matchup of supply and demand, math and science teachers. Elementary teachers are great, but they ought to have a focus in ELL or special education, so really getting that supply and demand matched up well between who's leaving teaching and what the needs of school districts are. We're focused in five areas in our effort. The one that I'm most focused on right now is working with these teacher preparation programs There are 14 institutions that we're working with. It's the largest investment that we've made ever at the foundation, $40 million over a decade. Huge for our board and for our foundation and our staff. So there's a focus on the teacher preparation program change-up, asking them to look at the way they prepare, place, and support teachers. We're also working with some folks out of the Value-Added Assessment Center in Madison, Wisconsin, on developing some great assessment tools to measure both individual and program performance. There's a teacher marketing campaign we're working on with the Padilla Spear firm, but also with each of these individual institutions, trying to drum up a wonderful recruiting campaign to bring great folks into teaching. And that will launch in April. We're looking at compensation and other improvements to the value proposition of teaching, and Peter will share with you some data that we worked on with McKinsey that just digs in a little more deeply on compensation matters. I hope you'll find that interesting. And then finally, the policy environment. We're a foundation. We cannot lobby. We can educate when you invite us to do so. But there needs to be a policy environment that supports and rewards improved teacher preparation. That's critical, or this won't work. So here are our partners in the three-state area. We're missing a dividing line between North and South Dakota, but those are two quite different states. One has lots of oil and the other doesn't, for example. But we're excited about this. We're still trying to figure out a strategy for the Western Dakotas, and we've been talking with a number of institutions there. So that's not just a blank slate. We're still trying to work through that. But we're working with 14 institutions. There's seven partnerships. So the University of Minnesota is our R1, our research institution here in the Twin Cities. We've got a great consortium of six private colleges. The Baptists and the Catholics and the Lutherans are all working together, six of them here in town. Winona State University, Mankato State University, St. Cloud State University, and then there's a consortium up in the Fargo-Moorhead area that is working hard called the Valley Partnership together, Moorhead, NDSU, and Valley City. And then we're also working with the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. So a little more detail here. These universities, these partners, have agreed to transform the way in which they prepare teachers and then to use value-added assessment in order to measure performance. So the four elements are recruit, prepare, place, and support. So just to give you some examples in each of these areas. In the recruitment area, I mentioned the marketing campaign that will be so critical to draw people into the profession. One of the things that was really surprising to us when we asked our folks, show us kind of what your current practice is, and then what's the way in which you hope this will be different once we've invested. And they said, well, we don't intentionally recruit. I mean, we were surprised. You know, they require a grade point average and a test score and that sort of thing, but they don't intentionally think about who it is they want to have in their program. Is it a second career person? Is it a current college student who might be great at math and science but might also have a service, you know, propensity? Is it a middle school kid? Is it a high school kid? They're not thinking, they have not thought about a recruitment in an intentional way, and that's something we're working very closely with them on right now. Look at preparation. Typically, there's been a lot of time spent in the classroom with the professor, and student teaching is kind of an add-on. They're really looking very deeply at the clinical aspect of teaching, making sure that clinical is sort of the core, for example, of your educational experience when you're becoming a teacher, and it's immersed in your academic learning that you're doing as well, and it lasts longer, and you might as well learn right away when you get in to the classroom, whether you like it or not, and not towards the end of your preparation program. Placement's critical, partnering with districts so that when these graduates go in to become teachers, they're clustered together, they're in a school that's ready to receive them, there's good leadership at that school. So we're asking our folks to develop MOUs or contracts or agreements with their partner districts so that they really have a mutual understanding, and we're encouraging our K-12 districts out there to be demanding of their of the partners that we're working with. And then finally, support. You know, when you go back to that pipeline slide and you see how many people leave the profession, we learn that that happens probably in the first 3-4 years. Teachers get tenure at 3 years, so if there's a way to provide support, that may help many more teachers become successful. So our universities, our colleges have all agreed to provide at least 3 years of support to their teachers and then use assessment. and then tie that assessment back to their program for purposes of improvement. We do not want to use the value-added assessment as a heavy stick, as a punitive tool. We want to make sure that information ties back to the institution so that they can improve their program. I'll give you just a quick example. When we did one of our summits with our partners, we brought a guy up here from the University of Louisiana. And in Louisiana, you may or may not know that they've got a law there that requires that their programs publicly report how their graduates are doing based on some state tests. So this fellow, Jerry Carlson, who's actually a Minnesotan by birth, is now at University of Louisiana down in Lafayette. And he has a great education school. They get blue ribbon, you know, they're honored all the time. They've got blue ribbons from all sorts of, you know, business organizations. Great education program until he gets his data and he sees everything looks pretty good except his elementary language arts program. And we brought him up to talk with our folks, and he said, you know, at first I was really mad. And then I began to say to myself, well, everything else looks pretty good. Maybe I ought to look at what's going on in this program. So this data allowed him to dig into his elementary, you know, language, his elementary program, and figure out what was working and what wasn't. And he was very happy to have that data. So that's what we want to use the data for, is for improvement.
I believe we've got a question. If I can just intercept, Senator Wheeler, you had a question.
Oh, yes, Madam Chair, Ms. Hegard, earlier, and actually I think your next slide, too, refers to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you know, for getting, you know, growth information. Isn't there something comparable at the University of Minnesota for getting this type of knowledge, and especially with the silo development of longitudinal data that's being done with our grant money, and you're going to be tracking data to make sure there is this growth? Why do we have to go to Wisconsin, and especially they're not a participant even with the schools here?
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, the folks at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Value-Added Research Center, VARC, they're nationally known for this work. Our University of Minnesota has lots of great assets and attributes, and they do some excellent research work. But on this thing, value-added assessment, they're nationally known. They're working in about 5 or 6 different locations across the country. Mr. Hutchinson worked with them back, I don't know, when you were school superintendent, didn't you, with Dave Heisted. So they're nationally known, and they really are the go-to people, one of the go-to organizations in the country for this kind of work.
And if I might, Madam Chair, we also thought it would be a good idea to have someone not from Minnesota be in the driver on some of this data stuff, so there'd be absolutely no conflict of interest. Absolutely no conflict of interest.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we're interrupting your flow here for just a second, I wanted to your map that has the participating institutions in there. You've got the Twin City Private College Consortium. Why are not the other private colleges in the state, the St. Olaf's, Gustavus,
Carleton,
why are they not participating in this as well? And I think it's a laudable goal to in effect, guarantee your graduates are going to do well. Was there a particular reason, or
Mr.
Hutchinson?
Madam Chair, we had this really sophisticated process. We put the word out to everybody and said we're interested in launching this effort. There are only 2 requirements. Requirement 1 was that you had to be willing to use data, in particular value-added data, to assess the quality of your graduates and use that data to improve your program. And requirement 2 was you had to be prepared to say out loud and then act on a guarantee, to actually guarantee the effectiveness. These 6 are the ones that responded. And that's a point I wanted to make. I mean, I've been in and out of public life a lot. I was in the private sector for a long time. These college presidents, these university presidents, these provosts, these deans, they are under no obligation to do this. None whatsoever. And yet they are literally saying to their K-12 institutions, if you hire our graduates, we will stand behind them. And if you discover that our graduates aren't delivering, we'll show up at your school and do something about this. This has never happened in history, let alone in Minnesota. The notion of a higher ed institution actually following and taking responsibility for the results that they produce, this is a huge deal. And we should get them to come and visit with you, because to see these college and university presidents talk about what this means. Judith Romaley, who's the the president at Winona and I happened to be on a panel together down in Rochester not too long ago. The room was packed, and Judith got up and talked about what this meant. And she got a standing ovation from the Rochester community because they'd never seen anything like it. And this looks like, you know, it's so logical and linear and all that stuff, but this is a act of courage, I think, for these institutions.
And leadership.
To really step out and say, you know, we get it. We get the future of Minnesota. We get what this means for our institutions and our communities. We get what it means for the kids. And we're prepared to go do something that nobody's telling us we have to do. And, you know, and you think about their situations. If you're a private college, your endowment is down. If you're a public institution, all your resources are down. And these university presidents are standing up and saying, no, we're going to make this happen. And again, it's one of those things you can't sort of get the flavor off this slide. The K-12s is a whole other deal. I mean, we asked them all these questions, like, who do you recruit? And the answer was, we don't. We open the door. And the second question was, do you know what happened to last year's graduates? And the answer was, well, we think they got jobs. Now what's happening is these school superintendents and curriculum people are in the room with the deans, and they take this stuff really seriously. It's really interesting. We were out visiting the universities this last couple weeks, and the K-12s are actually saying, send us people that do this. We were at one institution where they're revamping their curriculum based on the input they got from the K-12 districts, and it's stuff they didn't want to have to teach, but they're not getting teachers that can deliver that stuff. And so now the higher ed is completely revamping its curriculum to meet the needs of the K-12s. This is just a very different sort of supplier, you know, integrated supplier system that's evolving. When we started this, I thought, well, we'll see if we get anybody to actually do it, you know, and they're doing it.
Part of what you're describing, especially when you, my antenna went up when you talked about the gentleman in Texas and the, discovering that the elementary language arts, the teaching of reading. There's still a war going on in that, and that needs to stop and needs to focus on what research tells us can or otherwise we're going to continue that flat line on reading. It's got to change because kids can learn to read. And so I'll be very interested in what you learn from their data analysis and anything else along the way. And I'm hoping that your project will take that on as well and not overlook that there's got to be some change. It may be tough on some philosophical differences there that we've got to stop this either or. It's both in terms of what can be the tools that can help young people learn to
read.
Well,
Madam Chair, as long as you invite us, we will come.
Thank you.
So this gets to a little more to your point, Senator Wieger. So these folks are with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Value-Added Research Center. They're basically going to deliver for us a value-added assessment that will measure gains and effectiveness. And we've never said that it's just the value-added assessment alone, that there are other measures, too, that are important that really round out a teacher's performance. The data will link students to teachers and teachers to their preparation program, and again, to improve performance. It's not meant to be punitive. Then another really wonderful thing that's bubbled up is that in our 14 institutions, they've assigned one or two people at each one to come together and decide what metrics they want to use together to begin to evaluate teachers. So there's an entrance survey they're putting together, an exit survey they're putting together. They're really interested in the teacher performance assessment, the TPA it's called. You may have heard about that. So looking at a number of different ways together so that they actually own it, that's been a really exciting transformation that we did not it did not come from us necessarily. It bubbled up from them. This slide just shows you, I wish we had some ACT data because, as we know, in Minnesota, most kids take the ACT and not the SAT, but the data shows that the student profile in teachers is lower than that of other academic areas. So that's a recruitment issue. You know, it's why are the folks coming into teaching? Why do they tend to have, you know, scores, for example, even though scores aren't the only thing that matter, it's a factor that tend to tip more towards the bottom. So that's just an interesting, I think, piece of information. Some of the research we did with McKinsey on this recruitment the importance of recruitment really was fun. And so what they did is they basically did some surveying work. We surveyed new, high school students? Young college students. And then we also did survey work with Education Minnesota on people who'd been in the profession for up to five years. And they basically sorted these folks as follows. They identified a group of called change makers. These are service-driven folks. They really want to improve people's lives and make a difference. They're ambitious. They seek intellectual stimulation. Then there's a group called the altruists. They are also interested in service, pursuing impact and life balance. They tend to care what their friends think, like a little work balance. Then their reputation is typically motivated by what others think. They're more risk-averse, and probably we're all a combination of some of these things, but this is how the information sorted out. And then there are security seekers, basically folks for whom compensation is very, very important, and they seek a lot of flexibility and freedom in their job. And then finally, the mercenaries. That's the group that are focused exclusively on compensation, and they tend to be ambitious and overachieving. So each of these groups kind of shakes out to about 20% each. And the focus area that this initiative is targeted to is that really the change makers, the altruists also, but the change makers. And so we can figure out a way to target a marketing campaign towards change makers and towards altruists. You know, there's a better chance that we'll bring people into the profession who haven't been there before. I mean, look at regardless of what you think about Teach for America, they've been able to identify and attract different people into teaching who might not have been there otherwise. So this gets to the policy framework, kind of the policy environment, and I think as Mr. Bartholomew noted, there's both legislative and administrative things that can be done. So, and non-administrative and non-legislative. So under recruitment, these are some of the things that would be very helpful. Targeting a recruitment campaign, we've talked about that. There's some financial incentives like tax credits and scholarships and loan forgiveness that could help people come in to teaching. Looking at admission requirements, maybe beefing up those admission requirements so it's a little tougher to get in if you want to become a teacher. That's what they do in Singapore and some other countries. It's a privilege and an honor to be a teacher, and it's hard to get in. Preparation, looking at the program approval process. We're very happy with the Board of Teaching right now. They've actually been sitting down and providing time to our Bush partners to figure out what is it they need in order to get their programs approved by the Board of Teaching. Accreditation and graduation requirements. In terms of support, we'd like to talk about licensure if there's a little time at the end today, but looking at licensure and what's required. We really believe that there ought to be a quality standard, regardless of whether you come in through an alternate or a traditional pathway. What ought to matter is the outcome and the standard, not the input or how you got there. And then tenure, of course. Making tenure meaningful. We're not advocating that tenure be done away with, but we think that tenure really could be made meaningful. Data, how to measure value added in multiple measures, linking student data to teachers, linking teacher data to preparation institutions. And then finally, using some incentives, rewarding development of effective teachers rather than just looking at enrollment. So just those are some of the policy ideas and options that we think could be very helpful to this initiative.
Senator Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hegard, can you elaborate a little bit on the tenure comment? I know there's been some discussion about that. What do you think would make tenure more valuable?
Well, Madam Chair, I get to call you Senator Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson before. So when we say make tenure meaningful, it would be basically without being specific. I'm not going to get too specific here. For example, you could link performance, you know, to a continuing contract or agreement, something like that. So if you had student data, you link that to the teacher, you know, you could use that to inform a tenure discussion. And decision.
Yeah, if I might,
Mr. Hutchinson.
One of the ways to think about this list is to kind of put the word effectiveness next to everything.
Trigger,
so if you thought about program approval, for example, so what programs should we approve? Well, today, the strategies that we use to decide which programs to approve and not approve are really about input. How much time, material was covered, you know, that sort of thing. But you might actually think about adding to that, after initial approval, maybe there's a measure of effectiveness. Do the teachers produced by a program actually succeed in classrooms? Because what's the point in continuing to approve programs that don't deliver effective teachers? Well, similarly, on licensure or tenure, you could think about how could we make effectiveness in the classroom a more important part of granting tenure or maintaining tenure or granting a license or maintaining a license? So that's the big theme for us anyway. That's what we've learned from this process, that if we stay stuck in methods that focus on inputs, we'll know a lot about what came in, but we'll never actually know if it paid off. So why not turn more of our attention, regulatory, legislative, and financial, toward rewarding, recognizing, and incenting the effectiveness of the result that we get? Because we can tell now, as early as we are in this work, that we actually will have measures of effectiveness for teachers that can be tied back to programs and can be used, again, not as clubs, but as incentives, as ways to help the programs improve, help the teachers improve, and then we can use some of these regulatory mechanisms to reinforce that, if we choose to. And I can't help but think that doing those sorts of things would create an environment in which these teacher preparation programs, who've already stepped out there, right, they're already out there, would feel like you all were behind them. Because the truth is, they're out there alone. And there's plenty of people saying to them, why are you doing this? I mean, you don't have to. You're not required. You're making it harder for yourself. And I think there's a way in which you could say to them, you know, we get it. This is a good thing you're doing. You're moving out there. We can create an environment in which if you do what you claim you can do, you'll be better off.
Thank you.
And this is the individual version of that. I'm not going to try to read this slide to you, but Senator Wiegert asked this question about compensation, and we know that if we want to recruit people into teaching, especially those change makers, we ought to pay attention to what they tell us. So we figured we might as well ask them. Why have our own opinion? We can go ask folks. So what we're trying to test here is among five variables, which variables would most enlarge the pool of people likely to go into teaching? And the number one variable is performance pay, interestingly enough. And what we tested was a 20% bonus, which is not that's not $1 trillion when you think about the starting pay for teachers. So it's not a break the bank deal. But what we learned from doing this research is it's not the amount of money that actually matters so much to change makers. It's being recognized. It's being acknowledged. They get that they're not going to make $1 trillion as a teacher, but if they happen to be good at it, they'd like to be acknowledged. Remember who we're talking to now. These are 18 to 24-year-olds. These are millennials. And these people are serious about wanting to make a difference, and they want to be acknowledged for making a difference. The number two thing, interestingly enough, is the maximum base pay. Not starting pay, maximum base pay. So how high could we go? In this case, we tested the difference between a $75,000 maximum and a $90,000 maximum. That was the second most effective way to enlarge the pool. And this is a pretty straightforward mental model that young people are thinking about is, can I raise a family? So the maximum base is more important to them than the starting. Third on their list, not again surprising, is how long does it take to get to that maximum? So if you make that target a little bit closer, right now it's about 20 years, can we make it closer? That also enlarges the pool, because they could see that they could get to a family-supporting compensation. Fourth on the list is professional development. Now, again, remember who we're talking to. These are young change makers that want to make a difference, so they want to know, can I keep getting better? Are you going to invest in me? And they think of that as part of the compensation package. Are you going to keep investing in me? And then fifth on the list is starting pay. So this doesn't mean starting pay isn't important. But, you know, we've all been sort of, I think, at least I was, thinking the starting pay was the big deal. It's not the biggest deal. It's not unimportant. But, you know, moving it from $35,000 to $40,000 moves the needle enough to make it worth thinking about. But, again, it's not a a break-the-bank kind of proposition. So this research has given us reason to believe that there are compensation plans out there that could be designed, maybe even within the financial limitations that we have today, that would be more attractive to prospective teachers than maybe some of the systems are using. So we're trying to turn this into a tool that we can use to actually test out in real school districts whether some of these compensation models could work.
Madam Chair, I have a question before we move on.
Senator Torres Reagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hutchinson, I remember our meeting 4 years ago when we met with your counterpart in the Minneapolis Foundation, and I criticized this plan. And I have to tell you that these 4 years have been an amazing opportunity for me to observe you leading this effort, and I am very proud to see you moving forward. And I think this is amazing, and I commend you for being so strong and sticking to your plan in spite of the criticism that you receive from some of us and say, you know, I'm going to pursue this. And you said to me, this is not the answer, but it is a very important component of a plan. And I remember that, and I commend you for that work. So I want you to know that. But my question is about salaries compensation, which is related to this. Senator Thompson authored a piece of legislation that I am thankful for because he made me do a lot of research. And this is about salaries. And we move legislation to freeze salaries in districts. Mm-hmm. And teacher salaries is part of it. And we disagree. We can go into the I don't want you to go into the political piece because this is not the question.
Trust me, you don't want to take political.
Thank you. So I don't want to put you in the spot. But I said, you know, that this was a good opportunity for me to do some research. I've been talking to some teachers about this number that you mentioned, which is the half of the teachers are retiring in 10 years. And so some of the new teachers said, well, if you freeze the salary, most of the teachers right now are going to retire, and they have been receiving that, you know, that salary, the maximum salary already. So freezing the salary is just really not important to them. But for us, it is. So I've been talking to new teachers and say, you know, for us, we're not going to get an increase in compensation. So now we have to think about, you know, if we want to stay in this position, if it is worth it to us to be here with the starting base, because it seems like you're going to have these deficits on this front. Their concern was that we're not going to get out of this in 2 years, because I kept saying this is only 2 years, and the intent here really was to, you know, everybody's freezing salaries right now. And they say, well, I don't think this is going to be 2 years because we're not going to be out of these deficits for 2 years. So how long are we going to be here was the question. And so do we have to plan to get out? So my question to you is, if half of the teachers are retiring, you're investing $40 million, how problematic is this if we tell these new teachers you're not going to receive an increase? How do we work with this?
Mr. Hutchinson.
So I think there's great question. So I think there's probably two or three parts to this. The first is that the idea that salaries aren't going up is not a mystery to these young folks. Right, that we're in a recession. They get that. This is not unheard of. So, if it were totally up to me, would I like to be recruiting in the face of a salary freeze? Probably not. But I also don't think that people coming out of college today have any illusions about what the economy is actually like. I think they have a very clear idea of what the economy is like, and they'd much rather have a job than no job. But it's not a long-term strategy. Right, we're not going to get people into teaching and keep them in teaching if we can't change our compensation structures. So we've either got to think of this as a temporary condition and be clear that we mean it as a temporary condition, or if we don't mean it as a temporary condition, you're going to have to figure out a way to give districts an opt-out, a way out. Which might be designing alternative compensation systems that deal with some of these variables more directly than the compensation systems we have today. That'd be another way to get at it, to actually create an incentive for people to think differently about the combinations and permutations that are present here. because I think what we learned from this data, and frankly, the data for young people in college who are thinking about teaching, and the data for young teachers, because we did both, mm-hmm. are essentially the same.
There were very little difference.
So this says that this is not about whether you are already a teacher or not already a teacher. It says that if you're young, mm-hmm. remember this is all relative, this is how you think about compensation, and they would be very attracted to compensation structures that look more like what we learned from this data. So we've got to, I think, help districts think, okay, how do we make that happen? What are ways in which we could, maybe even in the context of a freeze, create incentives for people to think differently about restructuring their compensation, the structure of compensation in their district? I can't go further than that without going out and collecting a lot more data. But I think from the point of view of someone who's thinking hard about how do we recruit people into the profession, the fact that you might have a freeze is not by itself an impediment. If there were going to be a freeze on compensation structures for a long period of time, that would be a very serious challenge to have to go up against. So I'd ask you to, and, you know, as you think about being a partner in this, let's think about, well, so what are the creative alternatives we have to incent people to create structures that are going to be more attractive, even within financial limitations? Because people know their financial limitations. It's what we do inside them. And if we're ossified and stuck with the way it's always been, we're going to have a terrible time, I think, recruiting people in. But if we can create some incentives for folks, I think we actually could find ways to make the structure itself more attractive.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask how much time we have left?
We're supposed to adjourn at 4:30, but can we stay on for another 10, 15 minutes? Okay.
So as
Ms. Rattel would like to have a few moments for comment too. So
yeah, we're almost done.
All right,
we're just going to click through. So this is basically a rerun of what Jim Bartholomew told you. We're working together with these folks. We're focused on teacher quality, school leadership, data, and innovation and efficiency. These are the four ideas that the four organizations are pursuing. It's a sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity to make a big difference. I wanted to end with just a word about K-12 because. Just as the higher ed institutions are pushing out into a sort of uncharted territory and they're trying to do some courageous stuff, so the policy environment has to respond to that, and the K-12s have to respond. And this is a unique opportunity for them, too. For years and years, when I was a superintendent, I remember thinking, you know, the higher eds don't really care about me, and I'm just one district, and we hire from, you know, every higher ed institution in the world, and who are we to them? And it was tough. Now we're talking about a world in which the K-12s and the higher eds are real partners, and they're very demanding of one another. So we've talked a lot with the K-12s about the kinds of partners they need to be, and this bottom list is about that. They need to hire differently. They need to demand something like the kind of teacher that these institutions are saying they can produce. They got to make sure there's good jobs there. And a good job is one that not only pays well, but the principal is a good person to be worth working on. The school cultures are healthy and will encourage these new teachers. There's compensation, so there are things you can do on the compensation front. But at the end of the day, the contracts are written between bargaining units and school districts, and so they've got to solve that dilemma themselves. There's this issue about tenure and whether it's connected to effectiveness. Ongoing professional development. Right now, our school districts invest a lot in ongoing professional development. Can we do a better job? Can they do a better job of connecting that to effectiveness? Our marketing study shows that these young teachers want to know, not am I going to have some dough for professional development, but is it going to be any good? Is it going to make me a better teacher? And finally, the K-12 districts have got to get even more comfortable with data. If they are not comfortable enough already, they have to become even more comfortable with data, and especially value-added data, because it's going to become the lifeblood of an effectiveness-based effort. But what we can tell you is this. There is energy for this nationally. There's courage here in Minnesota, both on the K-12 side and the higher ed side. And what folks need, they're getting support from us, but frankly, we're here to finance the transition. We are not running teacher preparation programs. We're not financing the operations of a single program. We're here to help districts and higher ed institutions get through the transition. They need a policy environment and a financial environment from the legislature that supports their work over the long run, over these 10 years. With that combination, I think we actually got something pretty good here, and it's not like anything else in the country. All these other efforts that are going on, they're one-offs. They're one district here and one higher education institution there. This is systemic, and you stand, I think, in an absolutely unique position to affect the outcome of not only the way teachers are delivered and produced, but the quality that's standing in our classrooms. And I honestly don't believe we're going to get this chance again. So our board said go for it, and my job is to encourage you to jump in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hutchinson and Ms. Hegard. Are there any questions before we call Ms. Rattel up to the table? Why don't you come and be ready to make comments?
Just very briefly, when will we see the first rollout of graduates in the classroom?
Actually, the first teachers will graduate this spring. So we'll find out how they do. And that's a relatively small group from one of the institutions. And then this fall, we'll see the first big enrollment into these programs. And we'll see whether a recruiting effort can change the complexion of the kind of candidates that come into these teacher prep programs. That'll be the first indication, I think, of the degree to which this thing is going to pay off. And I can tell you the early data, tiny little early pieces of data, are really good. In one institution, they offered a relatively small scholarship program this last year and moved their average ACT score from 22 to 27.
Wow.
Which was pretty amazing to them.
Mm-hmm.
And just one little coda on all this. Let's suppose this worked for a second. I mean, just suppose that institutions can move those ACT scores up or can get these change makers enrolled in these programs. You know, you get those kids involved in these programs, the real issue is going to be for us old farts to get out of the way, because these young people are so demanding. They are so driven. They are so focused on changing things. They're going to change these programs. You know, once we get them in there and get them going, they're going to change these programs more than we ever dreamed possible, because they are so committed to making a difference. And that's going to be the real juice, I think, in this thing. It's like one of those flywheel deals. You get this thing going, it's going to go. And our job is to create, all of us, our job is to create the environment in which that can happen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Thieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'd just like to, as a Bush Leadership Fellow from a couple years past, I'd like to thank the Bush Foundation publicly for supporting me and getting my master's degree a couple years back here. I just wanted to flesh this through a little bit for, is the vision for the Bush Foundation that you'll transform the how teachers are taught in Minnesota, or is it more just that we're getting this wave of new teachers into the classroom? And I guess what I'm trying to think through is hopefully you'll use that value-added data that's gathered and then encourage other higher ed institutions to implement those changes so that it's not just the participating teachers that are in these programs that we're rolling out, but it spreads statewide subsequently.
So right, it's a twofer, actually. So these 14 institutions are fully capable of producing all 25,000 of the next generation of teachers. They have the capacity, they have the scale, they can do it. And like the young people enrolling in those programs, imagine those teachers rolling into our schools. The impact of all this new energy inside our schools is going to spread all over the place. And that's why I think this has leverage. It's that on the one hand, it actually is possible to change those 25,000 by thinking differently about recruiting, thinking differently about the preparation, and so on. But as they spill out into our schools, they'll have an even bigger effect. That we spent the last 2 weeks visiting with all our higher ed partners, and one of the things they were telling us about is the impact. One of the things they're doing is changing the way student teaching works. So when I did student teaching, basically I was dispatched to Lebanon, New Hampshire, and told to do a good job and come back if you can, and I got basically no supervision. I was on my own. I mean, it's the way we've done it for like 50 or 60 years. What they're talking about doing is what's called co-teaching. So you actually have two teachers in a classroom at the same time. You're actually adding to the human capital inside these classrooms. And what they're noticing with co-teaching is that the cooperating teacher, which was supposed to be my supervisor, grows too.
The mentor.
The mentor grows as the young student, and that's a short-term gain for everybody across these systems. And it's something we hadn't actually focused on too much, but you can see, we can see now that the spillover effect is going to be gigantic if we can get to scale. So this is all, you know, we're trying to ramp up to the scale where you're, now it's pervasive. Now it's in every school. It's in every school building. And it will indeed change the face of education.
Well, Mr. Hutchinson, if you said that the 12 institutions or coalitions of them that you're working with can produce all 25 and that meets the entire need, do you envision that some collegiate institutions need to go out of the business of teacher preparation? Because we've got about 29 or 30 in this state.
Well, it'll depend, I think, on two things. One will be whether or not the K-12 districts will hire their graduates. Mm-hmm. And if we have a standard or an expectation in this state about effectiveness, and if we have a reporting mechanism that tells us what the facts are, I think the preparing institutions will either have to get better or not.
Give them an incentive.
And I think there's also a question of whether or not there's an incentive in place that you all can think about to actually accelerate that thinking process. Because mm-hmm. we figured out how to get to scale for the 25,000. We think we have. You know, we're plus or minus something. We haven't focused on those institutions that aren't part of this. We're not against any of those institutions. If they all wanted to adopt these same practices, that would be fantastic because, mm-hmm. Those teachers would get hired everywhere else on Earth because no one else is doing this. But there is this question about whether or not, shouldn't we think about other ways to incent these programs to make this transition even faster?
But you are in effect, introducing an element of competition here and putting the superintendents and the hiring folks from the districts in the driver's seat, and they could have a great deal of impact.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair?
Madam
Chair. Ms. Hutchinson, thank you so much for your presentation, and Ms. Hegard. It's very impressive, and I think as we talk about alternative licensure, that is such a tiny little piece to bring those teachers in that really this is about transforming the entire conversation, and so they certainly don't fight with one another and certainly complement each other, and I think this is really groundbreaking, and I would expect that as you go forward, there's going to be 49 other states watching, and that hopefully it will. I don't know if other states are paying attention yet, but I would assume they will be. And then lastly, it seems like how we can participate is by making sure we, from a policy perspective, do the work to make sure the links, the data links happen, and the change in compensation system happens, and the change in tenure, all of that, which is complicated. But it looks to me like that's the enabling legislation that would need to happen in order to make this happen.
Madam Chair, yep. I think that's exactly right. So it's the program approval stuff, licensure stuff, tenure stuff, compensation, all that sort of the framework things that today are focused essentially on inputs. It's not about throwing all that stuff out, I don't think. It's about complementing all that stuff with a focus on effectiveness.
Yeah.
That inputs get you in, effectiveness keep you in. It's the same thing we would say about a young teacher. If a young teacher comes in, if I were a superintendent, a young teacher comes to me and they can deliver, that's great. They stay. If they can't deliver, they shouldn't stay. And so the inputs get you in. The regulatory approvals that we have today, but effectiveness becomes the basis for staying in and ultimately for rewarding those who succeed and not rewarding those who don't.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
For the inspiration and for your effort. Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecilia Rattel with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm going to keep this very short and concise because we already went over our presentation a couple weeks ago now. But just to remind you of our first priority of having an effective teacher in every classroom, and the work that the Bush Foundation is doing is certainly a piece of that solution. And with being a member of the Minnesota's Future Initiative, we have been working with them. So because they are not at the Capitol lobbying, if you guys have questions about their work or need to get in contact with them, please feel free to use me or Jim Bartholomew as a resource in getting connected with them. And if you have any other questions, please let me know. And I encourage you to make decisions about teachers in the next coming few weeks and months based on their effectiveness. And really think about that when you're making decisions. So thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Ms. Rattel, question. And you were a classroom teacher at one time?
I have a teaching, license. I did my student teaching.
Okay.
But I, yeah.
Just recently.
Yeah.
You've just recently completed that, Ms. Rattel. Okay.
Yeah.
And where I was going is, you know, you have a background there, and I'm wondering if the chamber and, you know, the others that have testified, there's unanimity that a highly effective teacher is the biggest impact we can make. Do you have a ongoing dialogue with classroom teachers now?
Ms. Rattel?
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, definitely. I have a lot of teachers in my family, and
the organization as well. Excuse me.
The organization?
The chamber.
Oh, yeah, yes. Absolutely. We have teachers quite often at our policy committee meetings, and Principal Mary Donaldson from Concordia came to our meeting this summer. Of the about 30 meetings I did throughout the state this summer, at almost every meeting we had at least one teacher. At some we would have upwards of six or seven. So they're definitely engaged, and a lot of them are on our email list because they want to get involved in the conversation. And I seem to always find them whenever we're at the same gatherings. So definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no further questions, thank you again for a very inspiring presentation. And the meeting is adjourned.